So this is Root Studies 376, Christian Origins. We have some idea of the books that we're going to be using in this class. I don't know if you were down in the bookstore. Any of you get down to the bookstore to see what they have there? What did you find? You want to hold any of them up that we can see what we have there?
I can see that book right there.
What have you got? Let's see, what have you got? What do they say? I can't see them from here.
Eusebius and Josephus.
Eusebius and Josephus, both penguins.
Yeah.
Right, that's it. What about that interlinear? They didn't have the interlinear, the Greek?
They did.
They did? Yeah. How much was that, the interlinear?
$25.
Really? Was it hardback or paperback?
It was paperback.
And they wanted $25 for it?
Something like that, yeah.
Wow, they're not,
There were no used ones.
No, we don't have any used ones. But if you're a real serious student of this subject, you would be good to have it for your life. So it's a good investment. Because actually mine, a student gave it to me back in 1973 just because they didn't want it anymore. And I've used it for the last 30 years or so. And it's been the most valuable thing that I've had because I've been able to circle words that I wanted to know and carefully follow those words. And therefore, it's been constantly growing accumulation of important words and things that I wanted to pay careful attention to. So it looks like a big investment at the beginning, but in the end, if you're really interested in study of the New Testament, and if you're really interested in the issues regarding Christian origins in Palestine, you can't go wrong with a book like that. Josephus is, of course, something you'll have to be reading on your own. Josephus is, we spoke a bit about Josephus, but with Josephus, as we said, you have the most encyclopedic presentation of data in this historical period. That you could ever imagine having for any historical period before the time of the printing press. Even as we mentioned last time, if you were looking for Alfred the Great in England in the 800s, you would probably have just a minor source of some kind which might give you a scattering of information. If you wanted to find out about King Arthur, we don't even know when he lived. There was a movie out recently where the woman that he's in love with is a half-naked bow woman. I mean, you can do anything with the King Arthur story because there's no data. So these are almost dark ages. And if this Dark Ages is in England in the 500s, 600s, or 400s, whatever it's supposed to be, what do you think is going on in Lithuania at that time? You know, nothing that people live in. They're living, and things are happening, but there is no record. So to have something like Josephus, or the period of Jesus Christ, is like absolutely staggering source. Particularly as he's got an encyclopedic mind. If you've looked at his work, how many have looked at it at all? See, he's got so many names and towns and, he tells you, there must be a cast of characters there in the thousands. And they're real live people. I told you some of my problems with the New Testament, Gospels in particular, Acts even more so. You can't even be sure that these are real life people. I know they are presented as real life people, but they don't come through as real life people. Plus the Gospels and Acts drop them. You don't follow them anywhere, most of them. Peter looks like he may be important, but aside from one or two notices here and there, the literature doesn't follow him. We don't know what he does in Asia Minor. We don't know how he got to Rome. We don't know what he does in Rome. We're some in early church literature, some intimations that he may have been crucified in Rome at some point, but no data about how, why, where, even the date. So, you know, you're not following a normative historical narrative in those documents, however affectionately you may or may not feel towards them. So they may be helpful, they may not be helpful. I mean, how are we going to distinguish someone like James, the brother of John, from James, the brother of Jesus? We think we can distinguish them, but can we distinguish them? Are they really two different people, or has someone sort of been playing a shell game with us in order to downplay one's importance and throw you off the track that this person may have been more important than we think he was? Why do I say that? Well, if you notice in the book of Acts, when we get to it, and we will get to it, James, the brother of John, who you may have heard of, he's the one most people think we are speaking about when we speak about James, disappears from Acts in the same chapter that James, the brother of Jesus, appears. I mean, one disappears and the other appears. And if you, of course, I'm a bit puzzled when I said that. Well, of course you'd be puzzled if you don't read these things carefully. If you've just gone to a church, you haven't read them carefully. Because reading in a religious setting is usually an inspirational thing for prayer, for inspiration, how you should live your life, the problems you're facing during your life, or in that even given moment, how they're going to reinforce you. You're not looking at them to see if they're consistent. You're not looking to see what little things are occurring that you may not have paid attention to that may have a bearing on the historical progression of events. So as I saw one or two puzzled faces, people who think they know these scriptures, but out of all the people in the class here who may think they know the scripture, how many would know that James, the brother of John, is removed from the narrative at the same moment that James, the brother of Jesus, is introduced into the narrative? Almost nobody would have picked that up. Well, that's extremely important, because James, the brother of Jesus, is not introduced. He just appears in the narrative about 5 or 10 lines after the other James was disappeared, beheaded, as he's put in the narrative. Then suddenly Peter escapes from prison, and next thing we know, he's going to leave a message for James. But we were never all told who James was. So the whole introduction to this important James, and how come Peter has to go leave a message for him, if indeed that actually occurred, and why Peter needs to leave a message for him, what's the role of James? Is James more important than Peter, which in fact it turns out to be the case by implication as you wrestle with the material. But we've been taught that Peter is the most important person after Jesus. But if you look carefully at the materials, he clearly isn't. Acts doesn't think he's the most important person, because Acts is interested in one person only. Who's that? Who?
Paul.
It gives Peter short shrift. A few things about Peter, and then Peter leaves town, and the next thing you know, it just is zeroes in on its main hero, Paul. So the person who's writing Acts is interested. You have to see the motives of a person and their aims and what's on their mind. If you don't even think they have an agenda, I think they have an agenda too. But that's just my, if you think they don't have an agenda, just what their aims are, what's on their mind, well, what's on the writer of Acts' mind is Paul. And so we would say Acts is written from a Pauline perspective. Now, one of the reasons I gave you this compendium here, we won't read them completely ourselves, we don't have time in here, but I give you two materials here, the Recognitions of Clement, which is only the first book, which is really the most important, and some material from the Homilies of Clement, which have a different perspective than Acts. These are called pseudepigraphic books. These are books that, I don't know if this is going to work, this pen, we'll see. I think I might have a better one in my briefcase. I usually have them buried in here someplace. Maybe it's in this box here. Here's one. have one, sorry. So, pick this up here if I can. Okay, so, by the way, no, you'll check and see if we run out of film, huh?
Yes.
Because I don't know what we've got that on. So, these are the pseudoclementines I've got in the packet here. Important chapters from them, and these are a narrative. These are actually Hellenistic novels. Hellenistic mean they're written in the Hellenistic period around the Mediterranean and Greek by somebody or some people. And the authorities, the people in power who control thought, the Dick Cheneys of that period, if you don't like Cheney, I happen to think he's not the ogre people try to make him out to be. And we saw him last night at the convention, if you look, and he hardly looked like he could be an ogre. He looked a fairly mild person, actually. You say, oh, that's just his facade. No, I think that the main problem with these people is that they think they're patriots. I'm not sure that they are, you know, ogres. But in any case, those who think they are would think they control everything, like Michael Moore would think, and therefore they would be called pseudo. Whatever they said would be pseudo. In other words, you're not to think that these are really something to do with someone called Clement. These are false Clements. Who do you think labeled them false Clements? The church. Because the church wanted to already make you feel like, one, this was forbidden material, and something that was less. Something that was less reliable than it might otherwise be thought of being. And it was actually false. They're trying to say it's part of we've now got to the point where we have a whole category of writing is called pseudepigraphy. False writings. False writings. Again, it's all writings that pretend to be something, but they're not. Well, if you want the opinion of most scholars, the honest opinion of most contemporary modern scholars would be that all these writings are pseudepigraphal. Acts is pseudepigraphal. The Gospels are pseudepigraphal. Writings under a false pen name, if you want to call it that. They may be written by the people they claim to be written by. They may not. Nobody has made any final determinations about that. The same with the pseudepigraphs. The pseudepigraphs are no better or no worse than these other writings. They're all of the same character. Point is that, as I told you last time, in the 300s, a church conference was held in which the process began of canonizing certain books, and then at the same time declaring other books decanonized or heretical. So the moment you got into a situation where there were true books and false books, then you get into the whole thing about heresy. And when you get into heresy, you start to get into controlling heresy. When you get into controlling heresy, you start getting into burning at the stake. Lato de fe. So by the time of the Middle Ages, anyone with heretical opinions was considered fair game for burning. And that went all the way up to Joan of Arc. And I mean, you get people being burned up to the 15th century. In England, they were still burning people in the 15th century, in the 1500s. I think in Italy and Spain to the 1600s. And they have all the records of the Inquisition. And you know, it gets pretty frightening. So when you think of what went on for 12, 13 centuries as a result of this process of Orthodox versus unorthodox, and the lack of Christian charity being displayed by those who were in charge of what was considered to be Christian, it sort of does raise goosebumps on you. And many of you today, I'm sure whatever denomination you are, would have been burned back in those days. I mean, certainly if you're Protestant, you'd have been burned. So, I mean, if most of you are Protestant in this room or have a Protestant background, you're on the way. And if you're a Catholic who has some issues with the church, you're on the way too. So, that is if you were important enough to pay attention to. And even people like Galileo were, I would say, silenced, frightened into, submission. He didn't want to be burned. It was be burned or shut up and recant. And he chose shut up and recant. Because there have been people before him, Giordano Bruno and others, who were burned. Savonarola and so on. Oh, well, that's nothing to be burned. Oh, it is. You really don't want to subject yourself to that. Pretty awful. So this problem of demonizing things, calling things heretical, has a very bad effect on thinking, creative thinking, as you know. So we're just coming out of that period. Sure, we're in the 21st century. We've had two or three centuries, but just a bit. And you see in the Middle East, they're not out of it yet. They're still living in that world. That's why people get beheaded and every other kind of thing, because there are groups that still feel that if you say the wrong thing, you should have your head chopped off. And that's coming out of the medieval mindset. And we think we're going to solve this in 20 years. We're not going to solve it in 20 years. It's going to take a couple hundred more years to deal with this, to bring people out of these things. The best thing, actually, is the internet for doing this. The more people are open to international culture from various areas of the world, the more open and wide-minded they become. But some of these people use the internet against itself, through viruses and other things, and use the internet to develop terrorist activities through. So everything has its cancer. Jet planes have hijackers, internet have viruses. Everything has its cancer. There's nothing that you can do as you move forward that won't generate the opposite effect. So it just depends how fast civilization can move beyond this. So in our little way, in a class like this, I think we're trying to promote civilization. That is open-mindedness, looking at other sources, not declaring anything heretical a priori, looking at all texts equally, even though we might personally favor some. Why would we personally favor some? The reason we would personally favor some is simply a matter of cultural heritage. We like what we know, what's familiar. Look, you went to a certain high school. I don't know what that high school may have been, but you went to a certain high school. You know the sports teams and so on. So even when you leave or go to college, you support the sports teams of that school. You want to know what in Los Angeles, you want to know what the Los Angeles Lakers do, or the Los Angeles Dodgers, or the Anaheim Angels, or one of those teams, or the Ducks. That's a local loyalty. The Arabs have a good name for it. They call it Asabiya. Pretty good name for it. It's group solidarity. Feeling of solidarity with the social group. And they said those bonds are very strong in the way they understood history when they were at the top of their cultural form in the late Middle Ages. The Islamic culture, was very advanced in the late Middle Ages. It's gone downhill, unfortunately, more recently. But it was at a real high point in the 12, 1300s. And some of the most famous writers in around 1400 was a guy called Ibn Khaldun in Spain. And he wrote a whole history on the basis of Asabiya, how strong the fellow feeling, the group solidarity was, made societies rise and fall. And as that deteriorated, the society or culture or city-state or empire or nation-state also began to fall away. If you look at our America now, our group solidarity seems to be disintegrating a bit, so maybe we're in a difficult Asabiya situation ourselves. But in any case, your preference of certain documents is based on the fact you come into the world a blank sheet, a dope, a nothing, a baby. And you're introduced to a bottle or a breastfeeding, and then you're introduced to certain things like ice cream and certain other things of that kind. And then you get a habit on these things, it's like a drug, and you prefer them. You prefer what's familiar to you. A few people are different, they want what's unfamiliar. But most people want the tried and true. Oh, give me an American breakfast, or something like that. They go abroad, oh, there's no ham and eggs here, you know. You know, and so on and so forth. Now, cappuccino has become an in thing here, even in America. But 30 years ago, you go to Europe, the American tourist would, oh, geez, oh, all you have is cappuccino and a croissant for breakfast. That's continental breakfast. I want an American breakfast. So it's what you were familiar with. And that's the same with that idea. If you go to a church, the Gospels become your culture, Jesus becomes your super being, and you develop an inordinate affection and attraction to him, whether you think it's justified or it isn't justified. Then you become defensive about protecting him. For the Jews, it's the same. For the Muslims, it's the same. A Jewish person may not even have read the law of Moses, but he or she will, oh, you're insulting Moses? You're insulting me? What, the law of Moses is a myth? It isn't. He didn't get it on Sinai? And so the person's back goes up. Say something about Muhammad to a Muslim, it's almost like, you know, well, if they could, they would go outside your back, cut your head off. I've seen these stares in my classes. Because I personally, all due respect to any Muslims in the room, I don't like Muhammad as a person. And not that I don't respect him as a poet, I do, but I don't think he's a nice person. I think he's a bit bloodthirsty. And I don't think he keeps his word or is decent in his behaving in his relations with other people. And I think he's extremely a megalomaniac in his approach to certain things. He's left us writings that purport to be his, so I can make that judgment. So I like Islam as a cultural phenomenon. I think Islam is a very great cultural phenomenon. If I speak to a Muslim person and I say, you know, I love Islam, I think the culture is really fine, and I think it's higher than the prophet itself. That can happen. I like Mormons a lot, and yet I think that they're probably on a higher cultural level than the Book of Mormon is. But if you say to a Mormon, you're on a higher cultural level than the Book of Mormon is, they'll get angry at you, because they have been told that the Book of Mormon is a high cultural problem. And I don't happen to think it is, but it doesn't matter. It's produced asabiyyah, you see. Follow what I'm saying, it produces this solidarity that the people feel are closely bound together. So it's achieved its purpose in a social way. And then the young people go out on missionary work and so on, regardless of what they're teaching or not, it doesn't matter what it is they're teaching. It's the experience of being together, the fellow feeling, the common experience, the group solidarity that produces the bond around a certain thing. So, in Islam, you can say the same thing. If you say then to a Muslim, well, I don't really think the Prophet's on the same level as the rest of this, they'll get really angry. They won't stop and think, well, maybe he's right. Let's look at that. No. They don't want to look at that. They get angry at you for saying it. And the next thing, if there's an extremist, and I've had enough of them in my classes to know, they've told me, if I met you someplace that wasn't someone on, I would kill you. They've told me that. Which is so stupid, it's mind-boggling, but that's it, that's how they think. And they feel justified in that. So that's medieval. I gave you that example, I don't usually like to give that example, because it's a dangerous example to give. I'm honest about it, I'm not insulting Islam. If you look at the person, I don't like Paul. I think Paul is a dishonest, scheming, egomaniac, promoter. And I would never give the word saint to him in any shape, way, or form. And I don't mean to hurt any Christian's feelings, because I actually support some of Christian history, too. It doesn't matter. I'm just giving you my own personal way of dealing with these things and how people react to that. People who haven't looked at these things, oh, you can't say anything bad about Paul. He's our saint. Well, you haven't looked at Paul. It's because of Paul that you're burning people. He says in Galatians, anyone who teaches a gospel different from my own, he is to be accursed. just right at the beginning of the election. His name was Pete, and he said, "Oh, you think I'm too accommodating to the opinions of mankind? I repeat myself. Anyone who teaches a gospel different from my own, he is to be accursed." See the letter to the Galatians. Repeats it twice. Well, on that basis, people like Eusebius, 300-400 years later, went to work cursing people who preached the gospel different from the one that they were promoting. We're getting that in these materials here. So, you see, what we're talking about is what we spoke about last time. The initial feeling about when someone says something you don't like is hostility. I don't like him. He's hurting me. I've been taught this. He's undermining it. Or she's undermining it. I really don't like that person. But after about 3 months of that person, you might come to like that person, funnily enough. Your initial feeling is negativity. I find that in my classes constantly. I find students don't really warm up to me. And they usually do, don't they, Noel? About halfway, two-thirds of the way through, when they learn that I'm being honest with them and show them each thing that what we're speaking about is based on and let them draw their own conclusions if they think that is a nice thing or not a nice thing. Like when Muhammad in the Quran says, "Don't come into my presence without announcing yourself. When you speak to me, speak from behind a veil. It would be better for you. After I die, you cannot have any of my women. That would be a monstrosity. I can marry 10 women. You can only marry 4. Things like that. I mean, this is like the words of a megalomaniac. Not a gentle person anyway. But the believer doesn't take those passages in seriously. So if I come to a passage like that and I show them, or we come to Paul, what Paul says, I'm a Greek to the Greek, a Jew to the Jew, a lawkeeper to the lawkeeper, a lawbreaker to the lawbreaker. I will do whatever I have to do to win. Well, we know what that is. We've heard that in pro football. Win, baby, win. That's the Oakland Raider ethic. That's also the coach of the Green Bay Packers in the old days when he said, winning isn't, how he put it, winning isn't the only thing, it's everything, I forget how he put it.
Yeah.
You know, something like that. But we know, that's the Western, that's epic. You win. You play to win, you know, whatever. Then he said, all the fighters at the stadium, using the imagery of stadium athletics, which he knew in Palestine was abhorred, because the Jews and of all peoples didn't like the Olympics, didn't like gymnasium. Because people oiled their bodies and went naked in them. And it was considered irreligious to be involved in things. So he then purposely uses the imagery to upset them of stadium athletics. He says, all of the runners at the stadium are running for a prize. But I run for a prize, their prize withers. I run for a prize that will never wither. Then using stadium boxing. That's how I fight, like the boxers, not beating the air. So he tells you his agenda. What is his agenda? Winning. And you know he'll have to do whatever he has to do to win. And he does. And by the way, Paul does win. Paul has won. We are products of Pauline theology, thinking, and the mindset. And so if I oppose it in some degree in my classes, because I don't think it's a legitimate way to deal with truth, and it's not something that I personally would admire, an approach that I personally would admire. I'm not into the power to the power urge of controlling, of winning. I'll show you the passages that it's based on. So someone like James, who is Paul's really inveterate opponent, and someone Paul is always criticizing by implication in his letters, and we'll see that, is not up to dealing with Paul. Because James is called the righteous one. He's perfectly righteous. He has no guile. He doesn't do things to win. He doesn't, you know, plot the thing out so he's going to win and the other person's going to lose. Who's that person who's Bush campaign manager down there in Texas, the guy, Karl Rove? He's not Karl Rove, you know? He's just out there for righteousness, good or bad. And when we see him, we find that that's exactly the way he is. And that's what the Dead Sea Scrolls, to a certain extent, are. And guess what? That's why they all lose. That's why they all lose, because they're dealing with much more diabolical people than they are. So these are the things that I think, since we have all this data at our disposal in the 20th century, we can begin to work on. But to do so, we have to be willing to open our minds, as I told you last time, and let these things in. So we have to take the pseudo-Clementines and throw the word pseudo away. We have to just take them as equal documents to anything else. There are no pseudo-documents. There are just documents. No documents are canonical. No documents are apocryphal. One document is not superior to another unless it's proven to be so by the content that it contains. All information, all sources, all input has to be treated equally until it has some characteristic that would disqualify it. Now that's how I would treat the material in this period. Whether it comes from a source like Islam, or a source Christian Church Fathers, or a Jewish source, or Josephus, or the Dead Sea Scrolls, all these have to be treated equally. Now, I have said in my introductory statements that there are materials, and I don't mean to be harsh, in the Gospels that, to my mind, undermine some of their credibility. That is the miracle stories, the exorcism material. Those are favorite things, and they're very appealing to young people or people in church environments, and that's not surprising. They're inspiring. We all want to be cured of diseases. On television now, I think 3/4 of the ads are curing from diseases. Used to be cigarettes and Coke or something. Now all you do is see, don't take this medicine if you have heart blood or pressure, or if you're constipated, or I forget what they, all the, I mean, I just want to have to take the sound down now, because the ad frightened me on television now. I hear everything that's wrong with me on the ad. All the drug makers are up there, you know, telling me why I shouldn't do this, protecting themselves. In flogging their materials, because they can advertise, and all the cigarette people can't advertise anymore. So, in any event, I don't know what calls that aside there, but all these materials need to be taken equally, unless there's something in them which is of concern. And so when you have exorcisms, for instance, there's one episode that's one favorite of mine. A woman with a never-ending bloody fountain. In other words, it's one of these menstrual bleeding women. I don't want to be crude about it. Touches Jesus and the bleeding stops. I mean, okay, that's really wonderful. That's how I got on that. So we all want to be cured, and so it's appealing. There's nothing wrong with that. Speaking in tongues. But it's not something historically, in a normal, equal historical setting, that we'd be willing, probably on a historical basis, to credit. You follow what I'm trying to say? I mean, something I say in all my classes, you may have heard it in other classes, if you've taken classes with me, is that, and I'm going to stop all this preamble and get to the subject matter that we need to do in a moment, but it's just introductory stuff. If you notice, people are prepared to accept in the past things that they're not prepared to accept in the present. In words, they will credit things that happened. Why do Jews believe that in Moses on Sinai, the rabbis then say to them, there were 600,000 witnesses to the event. Not that you want to feel like saying, wasn't there, Charlie? But in fact, you don't say that. But that's the proof. There were 600,000 witnesses that God came down to Sinai and a lightning bolt came down and that wrote things on some stone tablets and so on. Or Moses stuck his hand into his shirt and it was leprous and then he pulled it out and it wasn't leprous. Or Moses struck a rock and water came out. Miracle tales of that kind. Those are things that I think detract from the believability of stories, from the credibility of these things as a normal historical source. On the whole, I would take them as credible in terms of there were probably the Jews or the Hebrews were in forced labor in Egypt in a certain period of time. And they probably did go out at some politically troubled moment from Egypt. All that, I think, recommends itself to possibly being accurate. And there was maybe a leader who came from the Egyptian upper class. He may have been born Jewish, he may not have been born Jewish. You know, Freud wrote a whole book about that. Do you know the book that Freud wrote about that? He was very upset about his origins and had to try to deal with this whole issue on the basis of German research as it was at that time. It's called Moses and Monotheism. And Freud said that if it walks like a duck, if it talks like or quacks like a duck, if it looks like a duck, then it is a duck. Moses looked like an Egyptian, talked like an Egyptian, spoke Egyptian, needed his brother Aaron to translate for him because he was slow of speech. Freud says, well, he was an Egyptian. And the stories in the Hebrew Bible basically Hebrewize him. Say, oh, well, he really wasn't an Egyptian. You know, he was put into bulrushes, and the Pharaoh's daughter brought him up, but he was really a Jewish child, and so on. So there's all these stories meant to Hebraicize him, but Freud contends he was really an Egyptian who brought the religion of Akhenaten. After Akhenaten, the sun, one god sort of ruler in Egypt that had switched. You see a lot about him on television. The religion, they've just been learning about Akhenaten, the sun god, one god of Pharaoh, who changed the religion of Egypt about the time of Moses. So the Freud position is that some of Akhenaten's associates got a hold of the Hebrew slave tribes and taught Akhenaten's religion to them. It's it's an attractive thesis. There probably is some truth to it. Whoever Moses was, I don't know if he was an Egyptian or a Hebrew, but one thing the stories do make it clear is he looked like an Egyptian. Okay, so those things, you know, you can debate, and there probably was a leader, whether he was an Egyptian or a Hebrew, I don't know. And he was probably quite a powerful leader, and he probably did have a successor called Joshua and so on and so forth. But then the other stuff, like parting the Red Sea and things like that, you know, you begin to, you know, I've seen the Cecil B. DeMille picture of it, you know, walls of water on either side. We sure it didn't look like that, but we know that there were cataclysms at that time. We know that Santorini erupted several centuries either prior to that or at the same time. We know there were great tidal waves. There are places like Mont Saint-Michel even today in France where if you drive out at one time and you come back at another time, you'll be caught by the currents. Those scenarios may have worked in an odd way in the folk imagination to produce the stories that we have. The plagues, the locusts, the blood, and all that can be explained to some extent as the memory of a people working over, very like catastrophic details of a time period that they were thinking back through oral transmission. So all that can be actually rationalize if you get enough data about the period to see how the story came into being, but not that Moses did it all with his wand. Or Moses, you know the story, Moses threw down a stick and it turned into a snake. Then he picked the snake up and it became a stick again. You're all familiar with that story, right? Well, all of us, I think, are not going to credit that as an actual occurrence. But there were magicians back then, you know, people who played, and you know, magicians are very tricky. And people who looked like magicians, and apparently in the Egyptian markets and in other places like Crete and other places, you could make a snake assume a stiff rigor mortis type position, you know, when you were entertaining crowds, and then pick him up and then he would then begin to do that again. Apparently this is a known trick or phenomenon. I don't do it, but the snake trainer people were doing things like that. So it isn't that he turned a snake into a stick, it's that people were doing that kind of thing. Could stiffen a snake and then at a command or something make it wriggle again. I mean, this is what the magic people would do. We have the Hopi Indians out here who were doing crazy things with snakes when the Americans first came out to the Southwest in the 1860s and 70s and met these Hopi medicine men who were putting snakes in their mouths and doing all kinds of crazy things with snakes. So there are things that are done by, you know, shaman-type leaders and magician-type people with these creatures. So all those kind of stories are explainable in terms of natural phenomena to some extent. But when you get to the stories in the Gospels, walking on the waters and, Holy Spirit coming down in a rush of, wind, and everyone started talking crazily and stuff like that. And then, those detract from an historian's view of their reliability. You may not view, you follow me? If you're a person of faith, those may be the things you like the most. Because we all like cartoons. We all like superheroes. Someone told me that in Japan, Arnold Schwarzenegger is the biggest hero there is. So the fact that he's governor of California just plays right into their imaginations. They don't see him as a real person anyway. For him, he's the person on the silver screen. This is just an extension of his persona. They're so imbued with, they love superheroes. This is the Greeks love superheroes, Hercules, the demigods, all these people. It's normal. We love Jesus, so we like these stories about Jesus. But whether this is history is something else. So that's the problem. And in a class, as we said, you have to be willing to separate out what recommends itself historically from what is super history, supernatural history. Supernatural history belongs in the church, the mosque, the synagogue, the Buddhist temple. And whatever else we can do in the university, we will do. But super history, probably we're not going to be able to deal with. You'll say, well, no, I want this, what I want to hear about. Yeah, but this is what we can't do because we only measure natural phenomena that are measurable. And by their definition, miracles are unnatural phenomena that are not measurable. So university, scientific-minded people do not measure interruptions in the law of natural cause and effect. They deal with Galilean experiments. They deal with geometry. They deal with, quantum mechanics, which are based on probability and things. But they don't usually deal with the exception to their rule. That is, when a guy is dead 4 days in the ground, already stinking, and somehow he brings him back to life. That is not something that they're going to consider. So you'll forgive us if we don't do that either. All right, that being said, let's go over to Eusebius. Eusebius is a good place to start. And you guys, what we're trying to do by reading Eusebius is fill in the missing pieces. So, let me see the one I have here. Any last questions about how the course is going to be organized? A midterm, a final, and a paper. We're trying to get the midterm halfway through the course. I'll tell you the date as we approach. It'll be essay type of midterm. A few short answers to keep you on your toes if you're reading stuff. We will take attendance so that people, because I think what we normally do is, since people don't have an idea what they want to write about until about the last 3 weeks, and they're overloaded with papers, and a good paper takes a lot of research, that if a person really has a good idea for a paper, then they should go ahead and do it. But other than that, we are let people drop one and concentrate on the exams, or they can do a good paper and drop one of the exams if they want, but they don't take the exam and drop it because you got a bad mark. We'll count anything you hand in. If you hand in 3 pieces, the official quota for this course, we'll mark them all, and you'll be graded accordingly. They're not going to say, oh, drop one. No. It's not like, if you think you're not doing well, don't do it. If you think the exam you did, you're not doing well, and you don't want things to grade counted, don't hand it in, just do the paper and a second exam. If you think you've totally screwed up, you follow me? You can make that. And the other thing is that I worry about, don't be jealous of others. If you did 3 things and that other person only did 2, that's your choice. And envy of others is the worst thing in the world. Just carry on with your own self. Worry about you, what you think is right for you. I'm giving you that option because I don't want poor papers, and I don't want papers that you go and buy, because it's so easy to do now nowadays. And I don't want, you know, from the internet and stuff, and or the fraternity files and things. And I don't want to mark people off because of that. So if you've got a good topic that you want, and I don't have 30 topics to suggest to people, you can come up to me and say, I want to do this, is that okay? And I'll say, yeah, that sounds great. I wouldn't say, why don't you do this? If I said that, I'd be getting 30 papers on the same subject. You know, it's not my job to do that. If you have an idea that you really want to pursue, and something that you decide is better than what I decide, then that's a great thing. But if you want to do that in both exams, which I recommend, do that. But the reason we take attendance is I don't want, if you're doing a paper and you decide not to take one exam and it's the final, then I don't want the fact that you're not coming. I want you to be here so that you follow the material of this course. So I will mark it down when we take attendance towards the middle and the end of this course. If you're just going to do this and disappear, well, we're going to lower your grade. Is that understandable? So we still expect you to be here. We're giving you that privilege. We still expect you to be here. Is that all right? So that's, you know, the disadvantages I told you is that I would have to be, if you've only done two things, the guy who decides between them what you grade if they're not both the same. Three things, it's easy. But three things can count against you. Because if you get an A and a B, and then the third thing is a B, you got a B. If you have an A and a B, and I'm the one who's going to make the determination, then I might think you deserve an A. So, you know, you never know. You never know. So I want to throw one out. No, then I'm really against the wall. Everyone's going to be changing, juggling everything. Hand it in, it'll be counted. Don't hand it in, it won't be. Okay? Now, So we'll start off with Eusebius here, and we'll try to pick up our history of Josephus from Eusebius. So I have my own book, but I'll use this one with you. He starts off, and we'll just start following him a bit. Well, maybe we should, before we do that, maybe we'll start with Eusebius next time so everybody has him. Let me first just sketch Jewish history up to this time. So everyone is starting from the same point, all right? Do you think that would be fair to do? You don't mind if I bore you if you already know it. How many feel they all know it? Well, let's just sketch it out here. So, how's that thing doing? That's all right?
Yeah.
Okay. We've got some, I'm not very, very expert at this new kind of whiteboard. So let's say we start with Abraham.
Do we need another pen?
Yeah, I'll try this blue one here. So Abraham, actually go way back to Adam. But you get these supernatural, superhuman beings, go from Adam to the flood, Noah. The Jews reckon that as 5,000 something years ago. I don't think we can rely on their days. And maybe for their culture it's reliable, but not for the history of mankind, as I think we're all prepared more or less to agree. But then you get these supernatural patriarchs that live 900 years. Those are things they've probably been handed down by oral transmission to them, genealogies that they got from their ancestors. They probably didn't know what to make of those things themselves. They may have been talking about months instead of, you know, they may have been talking about lunar months and not years. Who knows what they meant by those huge lifespans? Or it may have been like Greek mythology, demigods, if you want, but I don't think we're prepared to really credit those things too much. Except that it is a folk memory of their own genealogy. I think we would go that far. And the flood, I know a lot of people love the flood. That's what I mean. Paul said at one point, I put it in the dedication of my James book, when I was a child, I saw as a child. When I grew up, glass darkly. When I grew up, I put away childish things. I wouldn't want you to put them away. I think literature is good, but you have to at some point be prepared to look at the world honestly and see if you're seeing the same things that you've been exposed to by others. I think I've been trying to imply, and we'll keep it up beyond this, that it all comes down to people not being able to distinguish between what is basically poetry or literature and history. They don't see the difference. They don't know what is real history from what is literary history. I'll give you an example from the Muslim world. All Muslims have been taught, based on the Hebrew Bible that Muhammad and his colleagues were working from and operating off of and inheriting, that in general terms, the Jews were referring to these kind of people in the Sinai Peninsula and in the Arabian Peninsula as the descendants of Ishmael. Ishmael seen as the descendant of Abraham's first son and his descendants. So they said, they're our relatives, we're like them, but they're from a different line, genealogical line. They're from Ishmael, the sons of Ishmael. Okay, as the Quran got moving, it's a very, very poetic document written by a tremendously able poet, intoxicating poet, so people who read it blows their mind. In the 20th century, for good or for ill sometimes, enthusiasm certainly is encouraged, whether it's always a good thing, it's something else again. Everyone then decided that we're all the sons of Ishmael. We're all descendants of Abraham. We're all descendants of Ishmael. Well, you had Coptic Egyptians, you had Syrians, you had Greek people in Alexandria, you had all these different peoples that Islam washed over. Some people may have even been captive. Some people may have been opposing Muslims at that time. But as their generations were absorbed, assimilated, and so on, they all became good Muslims 10 generations down the line. All the memories of who they were. Their parents may have been captured, killed by Muslim armies, Arab armies, and so on. So you may turn into the very enemy that destroyed your own people, something of what's going on in the Sudan now. But as the myth takes over, the solidarity takes over, you're all the same people. You're all the sons of Ishmael. We see it happening in this melting pot in America, although we now still see the different ethnic groups, so we're not all saying that it's all one homogeneous whole. 500 years from now, it may all look like one homogeneous whole. Anyway, so the myth is easier to assimilate than the actual history. I had a professor at college who put this very succinctly. Poetry is truer than history. It's not what really did happen, it's what people think happened. That's what it meant. It's what the poet said happened that was the real history, because that's what dominated their view of what history was. Not what actually did happen. So if I took the DNA of these peoples who all call themselves sons of Ishmael, I'll guarantee you that 3/4 of them are from some totally different genealogical background. And yet in their mind, they're all descendants of Abraham and Ishmael. That's what I mean about the myth washing over everything. And it's good and it's bad. It produces group solidarity. On the other hand, it produces an untrue view to some extent of history. They happen to really care. Okay, so these stories, you know, are ancestors that they thought they might have had. We come down to Abraham. That would be around 3000 or 2500 BC or so. Then we know Abraham has these different children, Ishmael, Isaac, and so on. But the Hebrews, by that point, are cutting loose the other descendants. They're only interested in the chosen line as they see it, the line coming down to their ancestors. They don't care about Ishmael any more than they care about Jacob's brother Esau, who would be the Edomites in the period that we're dealing with, the people in Transjordan. or in the Sinai, or in the, what's today, the Negev Desert. So with Abraham, you come down to the key figure of Jacob, who becomes Israel, according to the biblical account, when he gets God's blessing and so on. It fulfills the promises, takes on a new name, and this name is interesting, Israel. El is God, even in Arabic. Allah comes from El. Is in Hebrew is can be a man and can be a future. So normally speaking, Ish, it's really Ish in Hebrew. As this is interpreted in the Bible by the poet, man is El, God, and they tell a story about how Jacob wrestled with God. So this word Ra or Sarah or whatever is interpreted in terms of having a struggle with God. And that's how they, that's a poetic, that's not a struggle. Because probably what this actually meant was Israel, the same as Ishmael is Ishmael. The Arab. This means God hears. Ishmael, God hears. This is Israel, same form. God rules. But that's not how the poet presented it. But I'm sure that was what the original meaning of the term was. This is the people who have no other king but God, whom God rules. And I think that's a much more satisfying understanding of the term Israel than the one you get in the Bible. So here I part company with the Bible. Just on common sense. I don't think that man struggling with God flies at all. It's just that some clever poet winged it like that, and then everyone else, when it got into the oral tradition and finally got into the written form of the Bible, mouths it like lemmings. That's what I mean. At some point, you can stop being a lemming. Things that make sense, I think, should be accepted. Things that don't make sense should be questioned. Whatever the tradition is. So to me, in my mind, if I was a Jew, and if I cared about Israel, I would hate to think his name would, actually was based on wrestling man who wrestled with God. I think that's just a poet's baloney. I don't want to say insulting terms from the camera. I think it really means something really inspiring. The people whom God rules. Yisrael, God rules. That's a great understanding. I'm sure it's absolutely true. Okay, so this is around, let's say, 2000 BC. By this time, they're reckoning all his children as part of who they are, so we get the 12 tribes, all his sons as such. All this is still pretty mythological, I think, but it's genealogical. And then we keep coming down here to one tribal son becomes particularly important, Joseph, because he's the one who goes to Egypt. So that's 17th to 16th century. And he blazes the way to Egypt. Yeah, what's wrong?
Yeah, 4 minutes of
Yeah, that's right. Well, we're done. So he blazes the way to Egypt there. And then from Joseph, which is, we have a captivity period, and then we have a Moses somewhere around the 13th or 14th century, 200 or 300 years later, according to the Bible. And he's from a different tribe. And then we have an exodus of sorts, and then Joshua is his assistant, and a conquest period in Palestine. And so we're down into around the 1200 period of Judges, 1100 BC. And then finally we get the Davidic monarchy coming out of that, rising up, which is about 1000 BC, and the rise of the first temple under David, and David is not strong enough to keep his kingdom together under Solomon, 900 Solomon, and then it falls apart, so you get two kingdoms, one the north called Israel, the divided monarchy, the south called Judah, and you're from about 900 to 700 BC. 700 BC, the Assyrian conquest knocks off the north, and you're left with only the south, Jews. So from that moment, you have Judea coming from Jews, no more Israelites. So from here on in, we're with Judeans which comes into Arabic as Yehud, Europeans Juden in German, English somehow got to be Jew. So there are no Jews after that period. 600, this collapses with Nebuchadnezzar. The first temple coming from David is destroyed. We get a captivity period for another 40 years or so. The returnees start to come back around 540 to about 440. Nothing much is happening. Nehemiah and Ezra are in that period. And only a smattering of returnees come back from Babylon. That's the captivity period, and the Bible comes to a close. We have a few other writings that are sort of scatty after that, but actually the Bible goes into a dark period. And until the Maccabean period, which is 200 B.C., or rather 175 B.C., we don't have a lot of concrete information. We're really in a dark period. But then we come out of it with writers like Josephus and others, and who brings us down to the period of the Romans. First, the struggle with the Greeks that produced the holiday that the Jews today even commemorate as Hanukkah, the rededication of the temple. And then finally, the Roman storming of Jerusalem under Pompey in 67 BC, Pompey being Caesar's erstwhile colleague and ultimately his enemy that Caesar struggled with. And that's the exact moment of Roman takeover. So the Roman takeover in Palestine that we're dealing with that sets the background to the Christian story of 100 years later is 100 years before the so-called ministry of Christ. It's 60 or 70 years before the birth of this figure that we call Christ, and before his actual activity is a good 100 years. So you have to understand, we have 100 years of foreign occupation acting itself out in various ways prior to this. And we'll pick up there next time, but I hope that filled in a few pieces for you, historically speaking, quickly.